News Talk 590 WVLK. And now, here's Jack Patty.
Good morning. Welcome into the 9 to 10 show for Friday. It's the 26th of September. Brought to you by Landscaper's Corner at 1305 Old Frankfort Pike. Landscaper's Corner, Triple Crown Grass Seed, the best seed for our area. Available in 5, 25, and 50-pound bags. Call 225-9433. Our question of the day is brought to you by United Structural Systems, a professional foundation repair and waterproofing company in business for over 20 years. iFixFoundations.com, 859-254-7700. You think that UK can get back on the winning track and beat Vandy? You tell us at WVLKAM.com. Tune in for the results with Cruiser and Crew between noon and 3. Yesterday, the question was, should e-cigarettes be added to Lexington's smoking ban? 56% of you said no. 44% said yes. Well, this is a Forensic Friday. Commonwealth Attorney Ray Larson is with us. Ray, good morning.
Good morning, Jack.
Enjoyed very much the $3 tour that you gave me yesterday of your office, or day before. It's much larger and a whole lot more people than I realized. That's quite an operation down there.
Well, crime fighting takes it.
Yeah. No, it's very nice. Even though you had to steal some furniture to equip the place. Well, you didn't steal it.
Thanks. I appreciate all that.
Making that. Well, you told the story on the air once before about a bank that didn't need the furniture anymore, and you didn't
No,
have
it. It was a investment company. And they relocated, and they allowed us to have a lot of their furniture that they went, that they left for to go to a redecorated office.
Right.
And we're very grateful to Travis Musgrave.
That's nice.
Of Merrill Lynch for allowing us to do that, because we're just a poor, pitiful public service office.
Yeah.
And we got additional space for our victims' advocates, and we just didn't have any furniture, and didn't have money to buy it.
And Mary Houlihan is here, and the victims' advocate office on the first floor is just beautiful.
It really is.
It is nice.
It's so nice to have a place for victims to actually kind of spread out and feel as at home as they can during trials and other situations where we meet with them.
Well, it's very, very nice, and I appreciated the tour. Tell us what we're talking about, Dave. Who you brung?
Well, this is really a scary case, and probably one of the scariest types of cases we deal with are mostly young women who are stalked. And the closest thing I can that I can talk about that may describe a little bit of the feeling of being fearful of somebody is when you cut in front of somebody in traffic, for example, and you see the guy behind you shooting the bird and screaming in his car, and he follows you. Has that ever happened to you?
About a week ago.
Well,
seriously.
You look up and you think, oh, man.
Yeah.
I can't go home because I don't want the guy to know where, those kind of things.
Right.
Well, you multiply that times about 1,000, and you're talking about a young woman, mostly, who is being stalked. And this is a case involving such a young woman. We will not use her name, but we will use the bad guy's name, who is David Irwin. Kathy Phillips is a prosecutor in our office at what I like to say one of our real OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder types like
you mean that in a good way. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
hey,
yeah.
Kathy, good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
Yeah, see that calm voice? Yeah. So
you don't want her on your case if you've done something wrong. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. You don't. And it was about a young woman who had gone with a guy and broken up, and he wouldn't be broken up with. Mary Houlihan is with us because she dealt with this young woman a lot during this process. And it's a 2009 case, and it's a little scary, and it kind of gives our listeners the idea of some of the issues that people deal with, that we deal with. So, Kathy, tell us a little bit about the case, if you would. How did it all come about?
Of course. This victim was a UK college student, and she had a boyfriend, and she dated him for several years. She didn't realize at the time, and now in retrospect, looking back, she's become very aware of the cycle of domestic violence that she was living in with him. And this is a dating violence type of situation. It was the kind of relationship that her friends were noticing and her mother was noticing. And so instead of...
Now, what does that mean? That sounds like mystery.
It was a cycle of domestic violence. And these are kind of run the typical kind of relationship. They use power and control and different types of manipulation to control the victim so that the victim doesn't realize that she's actually a victim of domestic violence. So in this situation, the defendant started out with emotional abuse, verbal abuse, and when she would try to maybe break up with him or try to step away, he would even use threats of suicide to himself to control her. He would follow her. He would monitor her actions. And he would just try to control. He would even use threats of suicide to himself to control her. He would follow her. He would monitor her actions. And he would just try to control her, but she didn't realize what was really going on. Now, her friends were noticing that he wasn't treating her right, were hearing the types of things he was saying to her, were noticing that he was looking at her phone and following her when she would go places, and that this was not a healthy relationship. But when they tried to talk to her about it and confront her about it, she would avoid and would just basically start meeting him and doing things with him without telling anybody, and kind of hid the issues that were going on in their relationship. So even though everyone else was really noticing, and in retrospect she sees it, at the time she really did not. There are a lot of things that go into why she stayed with him, and one big one was that she thought she loved him, and she wanted to be in a relationship. And even though she should have known, and kind of part of her did know, that it wasn't a good relationship, she couldn't seem to get out of it. He wouldn't let her out of it. So this went on for several years, and finally this cycle of the relationship, he actually assaulted her one time and actually physically hit her. And at that point, she knew. I mean, she realized, I cannot be with him anymore. And she tried to leave him. But this is the most dangerous time for people, is when they try to leave. And she tried to leave him, and she tried to do it very nicely because she didn't want to instigate or cause more problems with him. So she tried to be nice about it. And she, you know, was still texting him and still talking to him and didn't cut him off, like, firmly and harshly, because she was afraid of how he would react to that. So she tried to do it in a nice way. And what it ultimately led to was, on her graduation day, she was graduating from UK college, and it was on May 9th of 2009, and she had been texting him during the week and just trying to say, you know, it's over, we're just going to be friends. And he would say, well, can I see you again? And so she had agreed to have this, quote, closure talk with him, because she thought that might ease him off, and maybe they could break up without having any big issues. So the day of her graduation, she went to graduation with her family, and he was texting her throughout the day, and she was trying to calmly respond, I'll talk to you tomorrow, I just want to be with my friends today. Unbeknownst to her, he was there, and he was watching the graduation from a corner up high in the the arena where they were doing their graduation. And she went on her way with her family that day. They went out to dinner, and then after dinner, she went out with her friends and celebrated. That night, she had decided to stay on campus with some of her friends because they were all out together having a good time. And she met a very nice guy, and she was no longer with David Irwin. So she met this nice guy. They all go back together to the house, and everyone's preparing to go to sleep. They were both going to go to sleep on a couch. And unexpectedly and shockingly, all of a sudden, it was dark, and all of a sudden, they're screaming and they're feeling very, very sharp pains. It's just an amazing situation. They're being stabbed. Both she and this other guy that she had met, who were laying on the couch, were being stabbed repeatedly. And they start screaming, and the roommates come running downstairs, her friends, and it's just blood is everywhere. It's just an absolutely terrifying nightmare scene. So whoever did it was gone. Of course, we know who did it, but at the time, the person who had been stabbing them was gone, and the police are called, and the ambulance is called, and they're taken to the hospital, and both the victim and the guy she was with just were stabbed multiple times, taken to the hospital. And when the victim gets to the hospital, she's worried about the guy because she just sees blood everywhere and she thinks it's all his blood. They get to the hospital and they discover that there is a 6-inch knife inside of her.
Now, wait a minute.
Stabbed. The x-ray showed the knife has been stabbed through her chest, just an inch from her heart.
It's
still there. So she's laying there in the hospital with this huge steak knife inside of her.
Was it broken? Was the handle broken off?
The blade broke off inside of her.
So that's why nobody saw it, I guess.
Well, and one of the interesting things I learned about this case, if we have time to go into it, when a knife goes into somebody, it's going to pull the skin to almost seal itself. Whereas if you see a knife wound, you're actually seeing where the knife comes out and pulls the skin out. So the knife broke off inside of her, and she's just the sweetest, most wonderful, polite, good girl, and everybody was focusing on the head wounds to the other victim, and she suddenly, in the ER, can't breathe, and she, you know, it even takes a bit to... Something else is wrong, because the knife had gone into her arm and then into her chest, and they didn't realize the blade had broken off in her chest cavity.
We're going to take a break. 253-5959. Touch star 590 from AT&T. Toll free from anywhere. 1-877-0590. Email jackpatty@wvlkam.com. Kathy, you summarized that case so well. I'm not sure you missed anything, but this is a short break. We've got 3 minutes, Ray. So what do you want to do in the 3 minutes before we go to the bottom of the hour?
Well, the story here is not only the dating violence and stalking and that sort of thing, but it's also has to do with the conviction. But this guy escaped. He escaped, and we want to get into that a little more. But the other thing I want real quickly to talk about is, as you told the story, Kathy, my guess is there are people listening out there who have family members who find themselves in maybe the same situation. How do you deal with that if your daughter or your granddaughter is involved in these kind of relationships? What do you do? How do you deal with it?
Well, I'm going to ask Mary to weigh in, but I will point back again to the fact that, I mean, these are smart young women. I mean, her friends were smart. They saw it, and they knew it. Her mother was concerned, and they did try to address it with her. And because she was caught in this relationship and didn't really see it herself, she did a typical reaction to that, which was kind of hide it. And so that makes it even more difficult to help people in this situation.
The hiding, it's pretty common too, isn't it?
Not only common, it's also, you know, one of the myriad of problems with our laws in Kentucky. Dating violence is not covered for protection. That sends a message to these young students. If the legislature is not considering what you're going through, domestic violence, it's very hard to identify a first relationship or a new relationship as domestic violence when you're stuck in this power and control cycle. And that's one of the things, you know, the family and friends were supportive after she did start standing up and getting out of this relationship. They were there to support, not to blame for not seeing some of these signs in advance. And that's one of the ways we can help. There's a lot of agencies that can help. We're doing a lot of work in the schools about making sure that dating violence is understood, that this power and control that these perpetrators use is not love, because they show up everywhere you are and they call all the time and they want to see your phone. That's not love. Mm-hmm. But if you do have a situation that you want help, Greenhouse 17 is our local excellent resource for domestic violence, and they have a 24-hour crisis line where they can give assistance to families and victims. It's 1-800-544-2022.
Taking a break. We'll be right back.
10 on it.
9:35, 25 minutes away from 10 o'clock. And if you have a question or comment, 253-5959, touch star 590 from AT&T, toll free from anywhere, 1-877-777-0590, or email jackpatty@wvlkam.com. This may be an old term, but I think I still hear it. It used to be called battered wife syndrome, and now they call it battered woman syndrome because it happens to people that are not married. Is that a non-PC term, or is that still used in the world of psychology?
That just implies that the victims can only be women, and like what we talked about at the break, violence is violence no matter who it's perpetrated on, and domestic violence has certainly had a focus on women, but there's absolutely male victims.
Right.
So it's
I guess my point is, it's a syndrome in which the person who is the victim has decided that the treatment they're receiving is somehow they deserve the treatment that they're getting. Right?
It's more of a cycle that victims get caught in, and it's a cycle of power and control, where the perpetrator is controlling behavior of the victim through multiple different ways. As I said, in this particular case, you see this kind of often, a threat of suicide. If you leave me, I'm going to kill myself. There's often, in a lot of cases, just so many different dynamics going on. Economics, children. I mean, there are just so many different factors that go into reasons why victims stay in these relationships. Mm-hmm. And there's an actual wheel that a lot of people have heard about, but it's called the cycle. And and you go through this whole process where, you know, there's maybe violence, and then there's called the honeymoon period, I'm so sorry, I love you, and they convince them to stay, and then there's just so many other dynamics that go into
it. Did you know all this, or did you do this in your research for this case?
Well, I enjoy learning about this because it is very predominant in criminal cases.
I see.
And
Kathy prosecutes, she's developed a certain degree of expertise
in this area.
And as a result, she either handles these kind of cases, or she helps other prosecutors handle them.
In regard to the title, it would be intimate partner violence is what
intimate
people are using
now. Okay. This is Jim. Good morning, Jim.
Yes, I'd just like to add, I don't know if anybody talks about this much, is, physical violence is one thing, but verbal abuse is also just as bad as, you know, it can tear you down over a period of years, and I think that's something that needs to be talked about.
Okay, we will. Kathy, is that the way it starts usually?
Yes, and that's how it started in this case. I mean, he controlled her in numerous ways before he physically assaulted her, and it's verbally cutting her down, or verbally cutting any partner down to where they feel like they don't deserve better, as you pointed
mm-hmm.
out.
Yeah.
And so that's just one of the ways that they use to control them, is to try to control their partner by cutting them down like that.
Right.
But there are also numerous other ways that they do it to try to control their behavior and keep them with them.
I've heard these cases before that you've talked about on the air, and one of many common threads seems to be the looking on the cell phone. Checking up on the cell phone.
Oh,
that's very common, isn't
absolutely.
It?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And in this case, I can go back to how we solved it, if that would be okay.
That's up to Mr. Larson.
It's a good time to do that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, as I said, they were stabbed in the dark, and he had fled. But after he fled, you know, police responded to the scene, of course, and very creepy. There in the kitchen was a pair of shoes. And one of the roommates actually recognized them as a pair of shoes the victim had purchased for David Irwin, the defendant in this case, and he had left them there in the kitchen. In the kitchen, there was a knife block, and there was a knife missing. That was the knife that was in the victim at the hospital. Prior to the victim and her friend coming home, another one of the roommates had been upstairs. This is one of those houses on campus that's kind of cut up into different bedrooms, but kind of thin walls so you can hear things. And she had heard something about 20 minutes before they got home. And she had actually texted her friends and said, "I'm hearing something. I feel a little, it's kind of creeping me out. Come home." And then when the police got there, they realized that the window to the basement, the cellar area, had been removed. So he had crept in that window and was in the kitchen watching, and actually texted the victim on her phone and said, "I'm watching you," with him.
Before he stabbed them.
So they immediately had the suspect. And shortly thereafter, the police received a call from the defendant's own father. He had come home and drank antifreeze. Probably wasn't really trying to kill himself, but they were worried about him. So they called the police. The police started responding. And he gave information. The father gave information to the police that ultimately led to the capture of David Irwin and his arrest. He was arrested on these charges and, unfortunately, was released on bond at his first court appearance. They put him on an ankle monitor, but we all know what you can do with ankle monitors. The court process went on for over a year while he was out on this monitor. He made two new relationships.
Why does it take so long? I mean, come on. What's the deal?
Well, he was out on bond, and this was a complicated case. We've talked about before the fact that in a criminal trial, we are not allowed to introduce evidence of, quote, other bad acts, all these other things he'd done to her. So there's a court process. There were motions. There were things being done in court to determine what would be admissible at trial, whether he would plead guilty, whether we would have a trial. And then there's just the natural way that the way the system rolls, slow justice. But we did ultimately get a trial date, and right before trial, he cut off his bracelet and fled. He had these two other new girlfriends who helped him flee. The police immediately became very active in trying to locate him, and the U.S. Marshals, and actually one of his own family members started giving information. And 3 days after he escaped, he was found in a hotel room down in Tennessee, and he was arrested and brought back.
Okay, so how did we resolve this case?
Well, we went to trial. We started a jury trial in this case, and as I'd mentioned before, there are very strict rules on what we can talk about during a trial and what of these other acts were going to be allowed to be talked about. And I had filed numerous motions and asked the court to allow us to talk about these previous acts of violence because they showed the relationship between these two people. And this victim, God bless her heart, I mean, she's a smart girl, but she's been through so much. And it's 3 years of a relationship. And, you know, we'd spent hours with her explaining, you can talk about this, but you can't talk about this. You can talk about this, but you can't talk about that. And here she is on the stand in front of a whole courtroom of people testifying about these 3 years of violence. And it was actually the cross-examination when the defense attorney asked her about one particular act when he assaulted her, and the question is, why didn't you call the police? The answer was, he was on probation and he would have gone to jail, and he begged her not to. That's why she didn't call
the
police.
And she couldn't say that.
And she wasn't supposed to say that, but it was cross-examination, and that was the true answer, and she said it
multiple times. So these victims start thinking, well, if they're asking me multiple times, I must be allowed to say it.
What's the appropriate thing to say? I can't say? I mean, really, what?
I think the appropriate thing is to say the truth, because it was asked by the defense, but the judge didn't agree. So,
so mistrial? Because of that one thing.
We were in the throes of a mistrial. The judge took a break, and it was our impression that we were getting ready to get a mistrial.
Did the defense know? I mean, was that a defensive move to get a mistrial?
No, I don't think so in this case.
Okay. In other words, not in this case. They've done it before.
I'm sure
in cases.
There are some.
It can certainly feel like
that.
It sure sounds like it. All right, let's take a break. We'll be right back. 253-5959, touch star 590 from AT&T. Toll free from anywhere, 1-877. Away from 10 o'clock, 253-5959. Touch star 590 from AT&T, toll free from anywhere, 1-877-777-0590. This one is a head scratcher to me, Ray. If you have a question or comment, we'd like to hear from you. Commonwealth Attorney Ray Larson is here. Assistant Commonwealth Attorney Kathy Phillips is here. And, of course, my personal fave, that's for your parents, Mary Houlihan. Ray?
Okay, Kathy, so you were getting ready to say what happened in this case.
Well, right there in the heat of the moment, and we were looking at a mistrial was where we were standing. So we ended up working out a plea agreement with the defendant. He had not been inclined to plea before trial, but I think he realized also that we had very strong evidence, and we were
things were looking bad.
Things were looking bad for him, and he ultimately, right then and there, we worked out a plea agreement. Everything's can happen very quickly in these kind of situations, and he ultimately pled guilty and was sentenced to 21 years in prison.
Okay, so what happened? That's not the end of the story here. So the judge sentenced him, and what did the judge do that created another issue? Because this is a violent crime, and it really takes something to have a violent crime.
It does
in Kentucky.
These days, right?
Yeah.
Well, he pled guilty to the offense of burglary in the first degree. There are certain offenses under the Kentucky Code that are termed violent offenses, and if it's a violent offense, it changes the parole eligibility, which is very significant because you're looking at a difference of 20% before you go to the parole board for a nonviolent offense. But if you're convicted of a violent offense, you must serve 85% of your sentence before you're eligible to even go to the parole board. So that is a very big difference. Burglary first degree is not in and of itself termed a violent offense, but if you have a serious physical injury and you're convicted of burglary in the first degree, it is termed a violent offense. So during the guilty plea, we said repeatedly, this is a violent offense. She has serious physical injury. There's no question he has serious physical injury. It's a violent offense. And she did a thorough job during the guilty plea. You know you're pleading guilty to a violent offense. You understand this is a violent offense. Yes, yes, yes. Then we get to sentencing, and he's sentenced, but through just inadvertence of just one line in the final judgment, in the written judgment that I have in front of me, it has everything that he was convicted of. He's sentenced to 21 years, and it just left out the one line that said, this is a violent offense.
Who was the judge?
It was the Ninth Division.
That's Kim Bunnell?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
And so afterwards, when he went to prison, we didn't even realize that it happened. It never occurred to us that it wasn't going to be a violent offense. And we actually received notice from one of the other witnesses, which actually is one of his other girlfriends who had begun communicating with us, and let us know that she had checked into his parole status, or he had mentioned to her that he wasn't being termed a violent offender by the prison system. So we immediately started filing motions to get it clarified. The judge agreed, and it was just an inadvertence in the final judgment that line was left out. She ruled that, yes, this was a violent offense. She almost died. We made that very clear and agreed with our motion and pretty much took our motion and put it into an order. And then they appealed that. It has gone on up to the Court of Appeals, and now they are looking at it. They made an order saying that it can be corrected and sent it back. But then the Department of Public Advocacy has now appealed it again up before the Supreme Court, so it's still pending. So ultimately, I feel confident that, I mean, the judge agrees, everyone agrees, and it was just an inadvertence of leaving a line out of a judgment. But at the moment, that's still kind of an issue. So,
well, and so the important thing we've also said here that I want to repeat is that if you do even have a question as to whether the relationship you're in is healthy, get some assistance, get some outside guidance on looking at that relationship and evaluating the kind of relationship that you're in. And you can get that kind of assistance at Greenhouse 17. Their 24-hour crisis line, again, is 1-800-544-2022. Because it's just so important. If you ask for feedback on whether your relationship is healthy, you're not going to get feedback that it is unhealthy when there's not a concern.
Do you know how this young woman is doing? Has there been any follow-up?
She's doing great.
Is she?
She's doing. Both victims are doing great. And she
We don't want to leave out the other victim. He's pretty beat up, too.
No, we don't want to leave out the other victim at all. They both were violently assaulted.
Yes.
And they're both happily, living happily ever after together, actually.
Good.
And
So they are a couple.
Yes.
Excellent.
And they both speak out on the violence that they went through and try and help other victims in their community and really nationally, because they've worked with some of the bigger programs that are trying to help young people see whether or not their relationship is healthy and when they might need help.
Jack, tell me, you and I had a conversation about Marlene Huff.
Yeah.
And that really kind of startled me. Why don't you relate that, if you would?
She was on the show this week. She comes in once a month, and she was on Wednesday, and she was telling me that traditionally it's been the male has been the aggressive person in terms of physical violence, and she deals with children ages 12 to 18. And she said that there's been a trend the last few years that's beginning to change, and now the women, or the girls, are being physically aggressive to the boys. And the boys that haven't been raised very well are happy to smack them back, but the ones that have been brought up pretty nice know you don't hit a woman. And this has created problems, and she says she sees it every week. And she said, just get ready for it, because this is a new generation.
This is the 12 to 18.
12 to 18-year-olds. And I was like you. I was shocked.
Well, I'd like to know, what does she suggest about parents recognizing this? Because this,
it's very important that they recognize it. But she said only 31 or 33% of these cases are ever even reported.
Yeah.
So 70% are nobody knows about.
Well, this violence amongst intimate partners is a big issue going on, and far too often we get somebody that does a Ray Rice thing, and then they then say, "I don't want to prosecute it," and that really creates issues for us, and it just perpetuates the problem.
Thank you very much, Ray. Thank you, Mary. Thank you, Kathy. Update from ABC.